You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Joel toka ingoa, nau mai haere mai ki te wai mo tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to the Wai Wharahina Monday. I'm your host Joel and I'll be with you for the next hour. Coming up on the show, I speak to the convener for the New Zealand Law Society's Criminal Law Committee, Chris Micklin, about the government's new amendments to gang patch legislation. I also spoke to co-founder of Deinu, New Zealand Jews Against Occupation, Justine Sachs, about calls for far-right figure and Holocaust denier, Candace Owens, to be banned entry from Aotearoa. Evie, what do you have for us today?
For our weekly catch-up, I talked to the ACT Party's Simon Kaur about more cuts to the health sector and the government's solutions to the ongoing energy crisis. I also speak to Chief Executive of New Zealand Nurses Organisation Paul Goulter about Te Whatu Ora offering voluntary redundancies. And finally, I talked to Greenpeace's Ellie Hooper about Shane Jones slashing fishing levies by $5 million.
Here at Ho'o Whakaaro, we would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch, tuku pātuhi mai, text in on 5395 or waiamairane. Give us a call in studio on 309 3879. Kaua e wareware e hei ana koto te whakarongo ki e nei kōrero anō hei pakihere rokiroki mā runga e te pai tukutuku o Iranangi Poho me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can watch all these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party's Simon Court.
The Minister of Health has admitted that Aotearoa's health system is in a crisis. There are vast staff shortages, many staff raising issues of burnout, long wait times, delayed diagnoses and an increase in telehealth services. Last week, Te Whatu Ora announced voluntary redundancies for admin and advisory staff, which follows the axing of 268 roles from the organisation's commissioning team. For our weekly catch-up, I spoke to the ACT Party's Simon Kaur about how the government is addressing the crisis in the health sector while continuing to cut roles. We also talked about how the government is dealing with the current energy crisis and which shortages of power are pushing up industry prices. This includes the proposed import of liquefied natural gas. But I started off by asking him about Te Whatu Ora's voluntary redundancies. Recently, Te Whatu Ora Health New Zealand has announced voluntary redundancies for admin and advisory staff, which follows the axing of 268 roles from the organisation's commissioning team. Health workers say this is going to adversely affect those on the front line. What does the ACT Party think of this decision?
Well, Health New Zealand is currently losing $130 million a month. That's an operational overspend that they have allowed to happen because they've failed to implement their restructuring plan that they signed up to. So when Health New Zealand told the government how much money they needed to run the organisation for 2024-2025, they said that they would need $16.7 billion. That's how much the government gave them. They've since worked out, actually, they're going to be in a $1.4 billion deficit. So a government, any government, needs to have confidence that people and the organisations delivering core health services to New Zealanders are actually in control of their operation and their budget. And that's why the government has replaced the Board of Health New Zealand with a commissioner, Dr. Lester Levy, a couple of weeks ago, on 22nd of July. And that is also why Health New Zealand is currently looking at the way it runs its back office. They have increased the number of back office staff between 2018 and 2024. So this is prior to Health New Zealand standing up. But between 2018 and 2024, back office staff numbers from district health boards and then through to Health New Zealand have grown by over 2,500. So it's just not clear what all these people do, what these roles are for, and what is clear is that people waiting for a doctor's appointment are not getting the attention that they need in a timely manner. And so that needs to be the focus of Health New Zealand.
Frontline health workers say that cutting these admin roles is going to have an adverse effect on their roles, not allowing them to work as efficiently. So what is the government going to do to address this crisis that frontline health staff workers are facing?
Well, I've heard that claim. In fact, I've read what the PSA union claims is an unhinged approach to managing New Zealand's health needs. But in fact, there's no evidence that adding 2,500 bureaucrats to the back office in the last 5 years have improved health outcomes. So, you know, I would say to critics that, look, we actually need to focus on identifying the need in communities, and then EDs, elective surgery, and all of the other things that the Public Health Service does, which includes providing for people who need dementia care and all kinds of other things. Work out the need, work out the resources that you need, and the organisational structure to deliver that, and then you'll be able to right-size the roles and so on. If they haven't done that already, that has to be the primary focus, and that's what Dr. Lester Levy has been brought in as Health Commissioner to do. But there's a whole lot of other stuff we could do as well. In terms of health infrastructure spending, a new Dunedin hospital should have been in construction and nearly delivered by now, but the previous government delivered and didn't agree on scope. In terms of, you know, how many operating theatres and who are the customers or patients who are going to be here. Well, years have gone by and the cost of delivering that hospital has escalated significantly and it's still not under construction. So there's a whole lot of other stuff we need to do in health infrastructure, for example, and I have a delegation to look into how we can make the most of the infrastructure we've got and get better value for money for that, which don't necessarily involve building enormous new facilities and then finding out that, crikey, we don't have enough doctors and nurses to staff them. There's things we're going to need to apply technology, systems thinking, process thinking, lean thinking, agile thinking to, because it's simply not possible to spend $16.5 billion or $16.7 billion a year and not be able to provide all the services that Kiwis need. There are savings in there. We just have to be smart about how we look for them.
All right, just moving on to our next topic. Currently, Aotearoa is also facing an energy crisis where power shortages are pushing up the prices for the industry. As part of a solution to this, the government is importing liquefied natural gas, which, according to the government, is better than coal because it creates less emissions. However, energy experts say that by the time gas is extracted, cooled, stored and shipped in the form of liquefied natural gas, any climate benefits over coal would have disappeared. So how do you respond to this?
Well, firstly, the government hasn't yet agreed to importing liquefied natural gas. It's a proposal that the government the government's asked for a feasibility analysis on it. But what the government has done is it said we will act with urgency to reverse the ban on local offshore oil and gas exploration. We're going to pass legislation to make sure that it's legal again to go and drill for oil by the end of 2024. We're going to remove regulatory barriers to the construction of those critically needed facilities to import LNG, liquefied natural gas. So the government's not proposing to buy the gas or to build the gas terminal, but we're going to make it possible to very, very quickly get on with the construction of that. We're also going to do some other things to ease the energy crisis. At the moment, electricity lines companies are very limited as to what generation they can build and then supply electricity into the grid. There's supposed to be a strict separation between the lines companies just owning lines and the big generators generating the electricity, and never the twain shall meet. But it's become clear that in large parts of New Zealand, what we call electricity distribution companies or lines companies, they have a lot of capacity to build small-scale generation, whether it's solar, whether it's fast-start natural gas, all kinds of things, small hydro that they can connect into their local networks that don't require a transmission connection. So we're going to make it easier for them to do that. And we're going to make sure the big generators that have hydro dams can access some of what's called the hydro contingency. There is a lot of water stored in lakes further up catchments that is not usually drawn down for hydroelectricity. We're going to need to make sure we've got the water there to keep generating electricity, not just this year, but through next year as well, which potentially could be dry.
Just moving on to my final question. There's been a lot of fingers pointed when establishing who caused this energy crisis. The current government says it was Labor when they banned oil and gas exploration. But it has been said that part of the problem was National privatising Contact Energy and then partially privatising Genesis, Mercury and Meridian as well. What does the ACT Party think of those moves that the National Party made?
Yeah, well, certainly National did carry out a partial privatisation. It's not as far as ACT would have gone, but you know, it was a good first start. The thing is, the part of the New Zealand infrastructure system that's actually working the best right now, believe it or not, is the energy sector, and that's because it's most of the risk in supplying customers and making sure that you have adequate supplies and you can make enough profit to pay all your expenses. Most of that risk is held by the private sector in the energy in the energy area. The problem we've got is that successive governments, and Labor certainly have played a significant role in this, have not recognised that the electricity market actually needs to be reformed at some point so that it's much easier to connect to to build generation, transmission lines, distribution lines. A lot of that comes down to RMA reform. I have the portfolio for offshore wind environmental management. So, you know, one of the things I'm working on in my portfolio is a regime that makes it easy to understand how to comply with our environmental rules for offshore wind developers. That's just one of the things that we're doing.
That was the ACT Party's Simon Kaur on continued cuts to the health sector and the government's solutions to the energy crisis.
That was Simon Kaur from the ACT Party.
How big is his hole? And do...
That is not in the public interest, I can assure you.
The Wire.
Recently, the government has amended gang legislation that would allow police officers to enter private properties of repeat offenders showcasing gang emblems, patches and insignia. The New Zealand Law Society sent an open letter, which was sent by the Society's Vice President, David Campbell, outlining their concerns for the proposal. The concerns raised include how gang insignia is identified, which, if the clause is taken literally, could be interpreted as printed reproductions of logos, which could make it illegal to own newspapers or certain books with gang insignia inside of it, increasing the risk of someone to be criminally liable around someone in possession of gang memorabilia, concerns that the amendment will have detrimental effects to communities and whānau in which gang members can reside in, as well as infringing on rights protected by the New Zealand Bill of Rights Act 1990. I spoke to the convener for the New Zealand Law Society's Criminal Law Committee, Chris Macklin, about the committee's open letter and the ethics of the amendment. The government has amended laws to proposed gang legislation. Can you explain what these amendments entail?
In short, the amendments entail for repeat breaches of public wearing of prohibited gang insignia and so on, that orders can be issued which will intrude into the home in the sense of prohibiting their display at home and allowing police to search people for gang insignia and so on and penalise them further for having it.
The New Zealand Law Society has written to Justice Minister Paul Goldsmith in an open letter calling out concerns around the new amendment. What are these concerns?
The concerns are that the amendment set out an amendment paper, so I'll just refer to an amendment paper when I do, but the amendment paper impact on some pretty fundamental rights protected by the Bill of Rights. The flow on for that is that it's going to impact on families, whānau, and those residing with gang members or former gang members. There's a rule of law concern about the way in which it's been done, the fact that it's been done after the select committee process. So probably the main thing for your listeners to understand is that the impingement on the Bill of Rights will be quite significant. The definition of gang insignia includes any item or thing to which a sign, symbol or representation is attached or affixed, and that can mean just about anything in terms of signifying gang allegiance or former gang allegiance. And it extends to as I say, a residential restriction. And really some concerns about that, because obviously people live in a whole variety of diverse arrangements, and it would be quite wrong to assume that because somebody has, say, gang insignia in their home, that A, it's theirs, or B, that they're somehow in control or responsible for it. And C, even if it is theirs, this is in the sanctity of their own home, where traditionally, unless something's impinging on other people, one wouldn't be having, you know, police and state involvement. So, yeah, that's the real concern.
Do you believe the amendment has been given adequate time to receive comments from the public and parties of interest?
No, it has not. The legislation under which it has been brought through was the Gangs Legislation Amendment Bill, and the select committee phase of that bill had already been completed by the time the amendment paper was presented. I don't have the time frame in front of me, but I know that the Law Society's letter was sent the 7th of August 2024, and my memory is it was maybe a week or two prior to that that I actually appeared in the select committee to be heard on the bill. So it was certainly after the select committee phase, and from what I've seen in the media, the government have accepted it was after the select committee phase, and they said that was because there was some more drafting and other work they wanted to do before they tabled that amendment.
Both Justice Minister Paul Goldsmith and Police Minister Mark Mitchell told Media Outlet Newsroom that the changes are vital as a component of the government's crackdown on gangs and public displays of gang patches and insignia. Is there evidence to suggest that such a move will help with the government's aims?
No, I have yet to see any evidence that it would help. I mean, the common sense position is if we ban gang patches, we'll see less of them, and if we enforce that ban by prohibiting them in people's homes, people might not have them around to take out onto the streets, I'm guessing. But apart from that lay understanding of it, I have yet to see any evidence at all. And the society and others have expressed concerns about the practical impact of prohibiting gang patches per se, let alone then supporting that with a prohibition that reaches into people's homes.
What is the New Zealand Law Society hoping for with the open letter?
First and foremost, we always hope with an open letter for engagement, so that those who are responsible for decision making are alive to the issues and engage with us, but more importantly the public, on what it is that's going on. So it's not an open letter designed to do anything more than alert both the government of the day and the public at large to some significant issues with the timing and content of the amendment proposed. The society itself doesn't want anything out of the open letter apart from, as I say, people engaging, being aware of, entering the discussion about some of the concerns that have been raised. Look, for the society, there's just one thing to understand, and it can be a bit mealy-mouthed or lengthy to explain, but the reality is that even amongst our membership, there'll be people with all sorts of views about the policy merits of what's proposed. So if you're going to ban gang patches, where they're banned, how, and how that's enforced, they're all up for grabs in terms of policy, and it wouldn't be for the Law Society to wade in and say that's a good idea or that's a bad idea. The main concern here is how that policy is being implemented. So we have a provision or a proposed provision that's going to allow the police into people's homes to gather evidence of aligning with a particular group or culture, or even having previously done so or have a family member that's done so. And quite apart from any policy concerns, that's imposition on your rights, such as privacy and freedom of speech, that needs to be seriously examined. And that serious examination would normally entail public consultation, which is not what's happened here. And so those are the main concerns for the society. We need to be really explicit that we're not wading in on the policy direction as such, but the way that this amendment's being proposed and the fact that it appears to be skirting what are some pretty essential, pretty important consultation processes is of major concern.
That was convener for the New Zealand Law Society's Criminal Law Committee, Chris Macklin, about the committee's open letter and the ethics of the amendment. Text us in on 5395 any of your thoughts on these pieces. We'll be right back. Keep it on the B.
Some velvet morning when I'm straight, I'm gonna open up your gate. how she made it in. Some velvet morning when I'm straight. Flowers grow.
Locomotion,
failure locomotion,
though your ego. Is it too late in the process, though, to change that?
Nothing's too late, bro. Everything's made up in politics. The Wire.
Last week, Te Whatu Ora Health New Zealand announced they were offering voluntary redundancies to admin and advisory staff. This follows 268 roles already being cut from Te Whatu Ora's commissioning team. The organisation has said that the majority of their expenditure is on people costs and that Health New Zealand needs to review its size and structure, adding that they're providing the opportunity for eligible staff to consider voluntary redundancy ahead of likely formal change consultation processes over the coming months. However, many health staff say a cut to admin will put more pressure on the already understaffed and overworked nurses, doctors and primary care workers. New Zealand Nurses Organisation Chief Executive Paul Gauta says that Te Whatu Ora did not follow the correct consultation processes before arriving at the conclusion that there should be redundancies. He added that any reduction of staff will impact on the people who remain, saying removal of supporting roles means that other staff must pick the work that they're doing, something he calls unacceptable. I spoke to Gauta about Te Whatu Ora's voluntary redundancies and the impacts they will have on other healthcare workers. Voluntary redundancies are being offered to admin and advisory staff at Te Whatu Ora Health New Zealand, but how will the potential removal of these roles affect those on the front line, like nurses?
Well, it's the view of how health is done, and health doesn't break down into those so-called frontline and backline roles. It's a system, and so nurses and doctors rely on a lot of what is badly called backline support to actually do their frontline work. And so it's artificial to make these sorts of distinctions. And if you look at admin roles, who's going to pick up that admin work? And already the doctors are complaining about the amount of admin they do. I know the nurses definitely are. So the questions we always ask here is, okay, if you're going to take those roles out, who's going to do the work? Because the work still needs to go on. And that's what's really frustrating nurses.
And there's already been 268 roles cut from Te Whatu Ora's commissioning team. How have you seen this have an effect on other workers so far?
Well, we're sorry to see those cuts in the commissioning team because fundamentally getting commissioning, in other words, contracts right, has been a long-term problem and just all across what's called the funded sector, the sector that's funded through those commissioning projects, are up in arms about the failure of the system to deliver what they need for the health needs of the people that they care for. So we can't for the life of me understand why cutting out those roles was going to lead to better outcomes for what everyone regards as a critical area of focus, which is primary and community health and aged residential care. So again, cut them out, who's going to do the work and how are we going to get guarantee quality lists as a result of this? And there's no evidence to answer positively in either case.
And you said that Te Whatu Ora didn't follow the correct consultation process when proposing these redundancies. Why was this and what should have they done?
Well, I'm not sure why they haven't followed the proper change management and consultation processes in the agreements. I guess they've just been panicked by the government's pressure on them to make the necessary budget cuts. The clauses in the agreements require proposals around, like voluntary redundancies or restructuring, to actually begin with the employer raising it with the relevant union or unions, producing the evidence to argue for the change, the unions to have a chance to consider that, to feed their own inputs on it and criticisms and whatever, and then for the parties to take on board what's been said, and then the final decisions to be made. What happened in this case is they just made the final decision, voluntary redundancies, without going through that process. And we know that that process works because it often leads to better outcomes and better decisions. It's there for a purpose. It's not there just to make things harder for the employer. And so this is what frustrates people. It appears that, and this is a matter that we are seeking to advance legally, that Te Whatu Ora have just walked right past those clauses.
And you also said that this move went against the values of Te Māori O Rongo, which is the New Zealand Health Charter. Could you explain a little bit about what these values are and how they've been disregarded in this decision-making?
Well, the values of the Health Charter Te Māori O Rongo are very much centred around notions like manaakitanga, kotahitanga, wairuatanga, those sorts of things. And that requires a careful adherence to the thinking and the values that sit behind those po. And in this case, where an employer's just up and made a decision without recognising the care that's required, and through Te Māori O Rongo, the Health Charter, we just think it's just totally unacceptable. You can't say one thing and do another thing, and that's what our members are being confronted with right now.
And for nurses and doctors and other healthcare staff, how have they been affected in their work through these cuts and the current crisis that the healthcare sector is in?
Well, it's really grim, quite frankly, for nurses, because they're finding already that positions that were already vacant are definitely not going to be filled, that the positions that are required to be filled through the workforce planning processes that exist, for example, in hospitals, and are being either not being filled or are being slowed down, which is essentially has the same impact. So they're living the effects of that understaffing, and it was bad enough before, but they're living the effects of that understaffing now. We think Te Whatu Ora are being cute in the language they use around this stuff. Basically, the reality for nurses in hospitals is there is just not enough staff. I think the situation is even more dire in primary and community health. That's with general practitioners, for example, organisations like Plunkett, Nurse Maud, and in aged residential care, where we think that the impacts of the big wage gap between the hospitals and those employers in primary and community health is such that lots of nurses are leaving those areas where they're really badly needed and either going to hospitals, or increasingly they're the ones that are going to Australia. So we're getting this awful labour market impact at the very time we need more trained New Zealand and domesticated nurses. Quite frankly, this is very simple in concept. It doesn't need to be overcooked. We need to get more New Zealanders into nurse education and training. We need to support them and keep them in those education and training pathways, and then we need to give them good jobs afterwards. It's pretty simple, and the system doesn't do that, and that's the questions we continue to ask.
And that does kind of follow what my next question was going to be, which is the health sector is obviously understaffed and overworked, and how could the government pull the sector out of the crisis that it's in currently? What do they need to be doing differently?
Well, I think it goes to that formula of getting more New Zealanders into our nursing education training pathways. We need to keep them there. That means more support, including financial support for them whilst they're in those education and training pathways. And then we need to give them good jobs afterwards, by good jobs, it means jobs that mentor them through the transition out of studentship into the workplace itself, We need to get the pay rates right that respect the professionalism of those nurses. And if it's in the primary and community health care area, we need pay rates that have eliminated gender discrimination. And that's not the case, and that's why NZNO, the nurses organisation, is doing extensive pay equity work right across that primary and community health to try and eliminate the gender discrimination aspect of those pay rates. Now, we did that in the hospitals. We're now seeking government support to do that elsewhere. So there are a few key things that could be done right now if the government had an appetite for it. But financially, they don't look to have the appetite for it. And so the language is all about cut, 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 not build, build, build.
That was New Zealand Nurses Organisation Chief Executive Paul Galter on Te Whatu Ora's voluntary redundancies. We'll be right back. Keep it on the B.
The boys jump into the water.
Wire.
I don't know, and frankly, the whole thing gives me the heebie-jeebies.
The Wire.
Calls have been made to deny the visa of far-right figure Candace Owens from visiting New Zealand as a part of her scheduled speaking tour at the end of the year. Owens, who has a history of Islamophobia, homophobia and anti-Semitism, recently, on recent videos uploaded to her YouTube channel, questioned key elements of the Holocaust, such as the well-documented human experiments conducted by Nazi doctor Josef Mengele, as bizarre propaganda, calling the Holocaust an ethnic cleansing that almost took place. I spoke to co-founder of Dayenu, the New Zealand Jews Against Occupation group, Justine Sachs, on calls for far-right figure and Holocaust denier Candace Owens to be banned from the country. Candace Owens, an American far-right activist, is planning to visit Auckland as a part of a speaking tour at the end of November. There have been calls to deny Owens entry into the country due to her history of discrimination against marginalized groups, with her discrimination extending to Jewish people and Judaism. Could you explain some of the anti-Semitic comments and views she holds that deems her such a controversial figure?
So Candace Owens has veered into outright, I would describe, Holocaust denialism. She's questioned elements of the medical experience that occurred against Jewish people. I believe she's also questioned, you know, whether the Holocaust itself was exaggerated. She has spread disgusting misinformation about Leo Frank, who was a Jewish man who was lynched by the Ku Klux Klan in the early 20th century. She also has been very happy to spread conspiracy theories around Israel being behind 9/11, et cetera, et cetera. So I would classify her as a really a classic anti-Semite and someone who's now veering into outright Holocaust denial, yeah, or minimization at the very least.
Are there concerns that Owen's anti-Semitic rhetoric could incite violence against Jewish communities here in Aotearoa if she is allowed to hold her speaking tour here?
Look, I think we can compare this proposed visit with what happened in 2023 and with Posey Parker, who similarly came to Aotearoa, and I would categorize with the intent of, propagating hate against trans people and queer people. So I think the risk there is similar, and I mean, it's well documented that post that visit that, that transphobia actually increased in Aotearoa. So I think there absolutely is a risk to all communities, you know, and I don't want to just single out Jewish people because Candace Owens is a hate monger. She has attacked migrants. She has attacked LGBT people. She's really someone who is a dangerous person, a very strange person. And I think there's a risk to a lot of communities in Aotearoa. And so, you know, on that basis, I think she needs to be denied a visa.
Previously, Holocaust denier David Irving was banned from entering the country in 2004. Do you believe the government will do the same now with Candace Owens?
I very much hope so. I think if not, that reflects backsliding in our commitment to human rights and racial harmony, really, and the Human Rights Act itself, right? I think this is someone who is like specifically coming to countries to incite racial disharmony and engage in hate speech. So previously we've had a clear line there that that's unacceptable, and I would hope that that is still something that the New Zealand government considers unacceptable.
As you previously just mentioned, Posey Parker was able to enter the country for what she dubs her Let Women Speak tour. The Auckland event faced a lot of counter-protesting from pro-trans advocates, which in turn resulted in her cancelling her previously scheduled Wellington talk, as well as cancelling another trip back to the country for the end of 2023. Do you expect a similar response from the public if Candace Owens is granted entrance into the country?
Yeah, I would imagine so. I would say that it's really important to just consider everyone's safety, and so I think I don't want to get ahead of myself in that discussion. Obviously, if she comes, I imagine there will be a robust community response. However, it's right now it's in the hands of the New Zealand government to, you know, prevent, I think what is like a really terrible situation where people are having to defend their rights on the streets, where hate mongers are given a platform. And as I said, there was well-documented rise in transphobia post that visit. And I think we really need to reflect on some of the lessons of that. And so I imagine there'll be a robust community response, but I think that the New Zealand government has the responsibility to prevent the kind of social polarization and scenes that, you know, we did see.
What would your advice be for people who want to show their support and have their voices heard in this discussion?
I would say that you can write to the Immigration Immigration Minister, Erica Stanford, and let her know your views on the matter. And, I think I think primarily at this point it's lobbying the government and just showing your solidarity with all the communities that this person targets, not, as I said, the Jewish community, the migrant community, the LGBT community, amongst many, I'm sure. She seems to be quite a prolific hate monger, if you will.
What is Diana hoping for regarding whether or not Owens will be granted access into Aotearoa?
So we're explicitly calling for her visa to be denied, as you mentioned, on the basis that in 2004, David Irving was denied entry. We are hoping that Australia denies her entry. If the New Zealand government refuses to act, it's our hope that she won't come to New Zealand if she's denied entry to Australia, because it's not financially worthwhile. It's financially worthwhile. So there's some hope on the horizon, I suppose. I think that we are seeing a rise in, white national, well-funded white nationalists online, especially on X, and I think some of them are trying to infiltrate the Palestine Solidarity Movement to push very classic kinds of anti-Semitism. And I think we in the Palestine Solidarity Movement are very aware of that. And I would just caution people to be aware that there are some very nefarious characters trying to, I think, take advantage of people's very sincere disgust and concern about the genocide happening in Palestine. And Candace Owens is one of them, I would say.
That was co-founder of Dayenu, New Zealand Jews Against Occupation, Justine Sachs, on calls for far-right figure and Holocaust denier Candace Owens to have her visa denied from the country.
Is the plague at all a threat in the modern day?
No.
The Wire.
Last week, Oceans and Fisheries Minister Shane Jones announced that levies paid by the fishing industry will be slashed by nearly $5 million. The levies are used to manage the environmental impacts of commercial fishing. This includes monitoring fish populations, making sure observers are on boats, and researching the impacts fishing is having on the wider ocean environment. The same day, Jones announced a bill that will extend coastal permits for marine farms by 20 years. This was opposed by Labour, the Greens and Te Pāti Māori due to the environmental concerns. Greenpeace says that Jones is prioritising private commercial gain over the well-being of the oceans. I spoke to Greenpeace's Ali Hooper about the changes made by Shane Jones and the potential environmental impacts they could have on our oceans. How will a cut to these fishing levies have an adverse impact on the ocean environment?
Well, these levies are used to manage and observe the impacts that commercial fishing has on the ocean. So they go towards things like cameras on boats, monitoring of fish numbers, observers, and wider work to look at what fishing does to the rest of the ocean ecosystem. So you've got to really think first about why these are in place to begin with. They're there because the commercial fishing industry in this country makes profit from their activities in the ocean, but these activities have a really huge impact. And if you're thinking about scale, I mean, commercial fishing is second only to climate change in terms of the threat level it poses to the ocean environment. So, yes, the industry has been required to foot some of the bill when it comes to monitoring the impact its activities are having, because, I mean, despite what some politicians in this government might think, the industry does not have carte blanche to destroy the ocean that surrounds us, that many of us have an interest in protecting. So the levies are being cut, and we know that that money goes towards things like monitoring and observation of the industry. So the question really is, how are we going to make sure that the ocean environment is not declining further if the money for those things is being cut? Is that then going to be a bill that has to be footed by the public rather than the industry that's actually profiting off of using the ocean in this way?
And will cutting these levies change the way that fishing is regulated as well?
I don't think it's changes to regulation that I have read. The question for me really is, like, where is the money going to come from? I mean, we have cameras on a portion of commercial fishing vessels. That was agreed to under the last government, and that has shown to be hugely successful. The first results from the cameras showed that there were far more bycatch incidents. That's when something other than the target species gets caught, like a dolphin or a turtle or a seabird. There were far more incidents reported as a result of the cameras program being rolled out. So in a very simple sense, the cameras are essentially giving us a more accurate picture of what commercial fishing is doing to the ocean. And that can only be a good thing, right? If you're pro-science and you're pro accuracy, then that's what those cameras are giving us. But I don't think that this particular thing about the where the levies are coming from, it makes any kind of change to the regulations themselves.
With this announcement, Shane Jones also announced a bill that will extend coastal permits for marine farms by 20 years. With this came some worries that this doesn't account for how the environment is going to change over the next 20 years. Why is this so concerning?
Yeah, I mean, I think the extension of the marine farm permits, it's really worrying. Like, it's worrying about the way that it was done, and I think that that is very in line with what this government is doing elsewhere in terms of, like, this undemocratic approach to making these huge changes. So essentially, consultation was not for very long. Most groups opposed this marine farm extension. They said, like, iwi and environmental groups and other stakeholders in the community said that they didn't want this to go through, but it's been forced through anyway. And essentially, there's been no kind of environmental monitoring of some of these sites. So we don't even know the impacts that these marine farms are having on the natural ocean environment, but they've just been extended further for another two decades by this War on Nature government. So yeah, I mean, this blanket extension of marine farm consents, for many of these marine farms, the environmental impact that they're having on the natural ocean ecosystem have never been monitored. So essentially, that's a really bad thing. Like, we know from overseas and from New Zealand that, you know, changing the ecosystem by putting these marine farms in place has an impact, often detrimental impacts on the wider ocean. And these should be studied. But basically, the government has just announced that all of these marine farms will get extensions for 20 years. And it's just a recipe for disaster, essentially. You've also got to think about how many stresses there already are on the ocean environment. You know, you've got commercial fishing, you've got bottom trawling ripping up habitats, you've now got all of these marine farms being extended for another two decades. We are changing the ocean ecosystem at an alarming rate at a time when we know we should be protecting more of it and allowing more of it to recover so that we can have a healthy ocean into the future.
So what should Shane Jones and the government be doing to ensure that our oceans remain as healthy as possible?
Well, I think essentially they need to take steps in the right direction to move away from ocean destruction and towards ocean protection. And the thing is, the science is extremely clear about this. You know, scientists around the world are calling for larger areas of the ocean to be protected from things like commercial fishing, especially when you're talking about destructive fishing practices like bottom trawling that drags up the whole benthic ecosystem from the ocean and destroys the habitat that the fish actually rely on. So we need to be moving away from things like bottom trawling urgently. We need to be protecting the habitats that we know are sensitive. We need more transparency around the commercial fishing industry, not less. So we need more cameras on boats, we need observers, and we need to keep up our studies in terms of looking at the impacts that commercial fishing is having on multiple species, because it's not just the fish that they are going for that they are impacting. They are also impacting multiple other species in the environment because it's kind of a food web. So there's lots of steps this government should be taking, including restricting bottom trawling, including putting more cameras on boats. But we really see that this War on Nature government led by Luxon is really heading in the wrong direction. And it's no surprise with Shane Jones as the Ocean and Fisheries Minister that we're seeing a lot of pandering to the commercial fishing industry. So cutting levies, cutting the money that they have to pay as kind of their due diligence for doing business in the ocean. Shane Jones wants to make life more easy for the fishing industry and screw everybody else, essentially, and screw healthy oceans.
Is there anything else that you wanted to add?
I think that I would just say that, you know, when we look at commercial fishing in this country and around the world, it does a huge amount of damage to the ocean system. You know, year on year we see tons of protected coral dragged up by bottom trawlers in this country. We see hundreds of seabirds killed, many fur seals, dolphins and sea lions, many of which are protected. And I just think it's really disappointing that what we see here is that the government is saying the commercial fishing industry can continue to do that, and you know what, you don't have to pay for any of the monitoring or the work to at least keep a track on what you're doing out there. It's basically completely getting them off the hook and saying you get to do whatever you like, and don't worry about monitoring the environmental impacts, and I think that's pretty shocking.
That was Greenpeace's Ellie Hooper on Shane Jones slashing fishing levies by $5 million.
That was The Wire.
Ko ira te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nei te mihi kia koutou katoa I kōrero mai te maua mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on The Monday Wire. Thanks to everyone who spoke with us today, the ACT Party's Simon Court, Convener for the New Zealand Law Society's Criminal Law Committee, Chris Macklin, New Zealand Nurses Organisation Chief Executive, Paul Golter, co-founder of Dayenu, New Zealand Jews Against Occupation, Justine Sachs, and Greenpeace's Ali Hooper. Nei rā hoki te mihi ki a koto e whakaroko ana. Thanks for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is The 1 to 4 with Otto, who will be looking after the show in Penny's stead.
Podcast. To hear more, head to 95bfm.com/bcasts.